Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, after years of searching, scientists announced the first direct evidence of gravitational waves. It's a discovery with roots in thinking that go back a century, back to Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. There are ripples in the fabric of space and time, he theorized, gravitational waves. And now we know the evidence is in. We cannot just see, but hear the universe. We have members of the team that nailed the evidence with us today, this hour, On Point: Gravitational Waves, a new era of astronomy and a new way of understanding the universe. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready to dive into the ripples of space and time and what they mean? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Thursday in Washington, D.C., Dave Reitz, Caltech physicist, executive director of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, announced that scientists had finally detected ripples in the fabric of space-time, as Einstein predicted.
We have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
We're going right to the heart of the team that did it today. Joining me first from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Gabriela Gonzalez, professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University, a leader of the research group analyzing data at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, in Livingston, Louisiana, spokesperson for the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. Gabriela Gonzalez, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's so nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. We're going to hear in just a moment from your colleagues, Ray Weiss and Nirgis Mavalvala, who are both with me in the studio right now listening to you, Gabriela. Can you just describe the observatory in Louisiana? What does it look like? What's the structure of it? What is the role that it played in this discovery?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that there are two observatories. Of course, the one in Louisiana is my favorite because it's close by.
Yes, great.
The other one is in Hanford, Washington.
Washington
State. Mm-hmm. But both are identical. They are L-shaped, 4 kilometers on the side. That's 2.5 miles, where there's a laser beam that is split in two to travel in vacuum tubes through those 2.5 miles to find mirrors at the end, come back, interfere, and in the interference, tell us about the difference in distance between the times they traveled. And that is what telling us about the distortions of space-time by looking at that the light that comes out of the interferometer on a photodiode.
How long have these observatories been functioning, and how and why is it that you've just come up with this evidence?
Well, the National Science Foundation gave the funding for building and operating these observatories in the early 90s, and Ray Weiss was one of the main people presenting the idea and making it work since then. It is operated by Caltech and MIT. The LIGO collaboration is a much, much broader group of people that look at the data and have found, it is us together who have found the evidence in the light that comes out of the detector. We found these waveforms, identical waveforms, in Hanford, Washington, and in Livingston, Louisiana. And that's what told us that we were really seeing these ripples in space-time going through Earth.
How long have you been listening for these ripples?
Oh, like I said, the observatories began being built more than 20 years ago now. We took with the initial LIGO detectors, which we knew were unlikely to detect gravitational waves, but we needed to test the technology, and of course we could be lucky. We operated those between 2001 and 2010. So that was a long time. But we knew that it was the second phase, the advanced LIGO detectors, the ones who would be likely to detect these gravitational waves. We began operating them in 2015, and we were so lucky to see this signal in the first month that we were taking data.
And what was the major change in the construction or operation of the observatory with this second phase that led to the discovery?
Well, the civil construction, it's the same. So if you look at the observatories from outside, they look identical in the initial and advanced phase. The vacuum system is the same. The facilities are the same. But everything inside the vacuum system was changed. The laser is more powerful. The mirrors are suspended in very sophisticated ways from an even more sophisticated seismic isolation system. We have better and different ways of reading the signal and controlling the mirrors. Everything is 10 times better.
And with that, we found this. And here, the sound, the chirp pattern of gravitational waves, discovered September 14th, 2015, just shown to the world last week. This chirp, as it's called, set to a higher frequency suited to human ears. Audio here is courtesy of LIGO. It's so short and such a big deal. Gabriela, with that in our ears, I want to have a little reunion right here. Ray Weiss, who you just mentioned, is with us, Professor Emeritus of Physics at MIT, co-founder, leader of LIGO, the LIGO effort at MIT. Ray Weiss, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Congratulations. Glad to be here. Congratulations.
Congratulate everyone.
Everybody right across the team. And with us in the studio, Nirgis Mavalvala, who's with us, Professor of Astrophysics, Associate Department Head of Physics at MIT, project lead on LIGO, spent the last 25 years with Ray Weiss looking to detect gravitational waves. Nirgis, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
And
thank
please
you.
Say hi to Gabriela, who you, I'm
hi,
sure you
Gabby.
Know.
Hi, Gabby. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Gabby.
So we all got in on the party just last week with the announcement. There's a big announcement coming. We all heard that. But you've known this for months now. Did you do your celebrating back in September? Ray?
No, we celebrated last night or two nights ago for the first time.
Oh, but you didn't. You heard it.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff between seeing the signal and then believing that the signal is real. And that takes a lot of effort. You have to check many, many things in the apparatus before you believe something. And there's not a very good history in this field before. In other words, there have been other claims
right.
of detection. You have to deal with that. The fact was a fairly recent one from a very good experiment, which just happened to run into some trouble with dust. We know about that. But that's a good experiment. That experiment will show gravitational waves eventually. But so you have a lot of things to check to make sure that you have something right. And I'll give you some examples of the things that you have to do. For example, as Gabby pointed out, we have two of these. Now, that isn't just for fun. You do that for very good reason.
Louisiana and Washington State.
Mm-hmm. Because you demand, and let me give you the things that you require so that you will believe it. Mm-hmm. The very first thing you have to require is that the signals be identical in the two sites. Gravitational waves, we believe, travel at the velocity of light. In fact, with that, those two sites, you can get a little bit of an idea where the source might be that is making this. For example, in this current detection, we found that the gravitational wave that we'll be talking about hit Louisiana first, and 7 milliseconds, 7/1000th of a second later, it hit Washington. Now, that gives you some idea, for example, that is somewhere in the southern sky.
Okay? So you can triangulate a little bit off
that's
that
right,
differential.
But you need many more detectors to do it properly.
Yeah.
So let me go back to the validation of it. That's the validation of it, is it that within those seven milliseconds, you have identical signals in both places. That's only the beginning of all the testing that has to be done. The other testing is that each of the instruments themselves, both the instrument in Louisiana as well as the one in Washington, are associated with a bank of other instruments that measure all sorts of things in the environment. For example, how much the ground is shaking, how much the wind is blowing, how much the magnetic fields that are changing in the Earth are changing, whether there's radio frequency interference, a whole bunch of physical parameters that we measure simultaneously. And what our demand is that locally at each site, you look and see if there's a signal in one of those detectors for the ancillary signals, the environmental signals, is coincident with what we think is a gravitational wave, that vetoes the gravitational wave.
So it can't just be a heavy truck rumbling by.
You see plenty of those. And in Louisiana, people are felling trees around us.
Yeah.
And up in Washington State, they're trying to get rid of the nuclear waste from Hanford. And that's making a hell of a racket, too.
Yeah.
So
it
turns out there's lots of things that can interfere. But we're not done yet. There's still one more. There's something like 100,000 signals that come out of the instrument itself. The device that you called an interferometer, which it truly is. And those all have to register no signature at all when we see this wave. And that is then the real beginning of it. Okay? And that's something that's new to this experiment.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons the experiment took a long time to build. It also is a thing that makes it take a long time to analyze. But you're not done yet completely. You then look at the data very carefully.
Yes.
And you see, can you divine out of that data, does it match, for example, Albert Einstein's theory for what you make a model for what it is and you see if it matches it. And in our case, and this is a story we'll tell later more, it matched this particular source that we'd been thinking about and Einstein probably didn't think about because it was not something he liked. These black holes were something which were an anathema to a lot of people. But it matched the signals from two black holes that were in spiraling and merging to make a new black hole. We'll should talk more about that later.
In spiraling black holes, Nirgis, in half a minute, it's what we have before the break. What is the significance of this?
So black holes can be born in pairs or they find each other and pair up. And what they do is they do a dance around each other. The laws of physics compel them to do this dance. And as part of that, they radiate gravitational waves. Energy is lost. And because of this loss of energy, they spiral in and crash into each other. And that's what the in-spiral is called. And it's a very particular kind of signal, the chirp heard across the universe that we've all been talking about. And that was a signature of an in-spiral.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the discovery, the direct evidence of gravitational waves, Albert Einstein's century-old theory now confirmed, and what that means for our understanding of the universe and the warping of space and time, the future of the cosmos, and maybe our interaction with it. We have with us a good piece of a very large team, but a very important piece with us today. Ray Weiss is with us, Professor Emeritus of Physics at MIT, co-founder, leader of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, acronym LIGO effort at MIT Caltech, of course, right in the middle of this. From Louisiana, Louisiana State University, Gabriela Gonzalez joins us, a leading member both in theory and experiment of LIGO out of Livingston, Louisiana, and with us in the studio, Nirgis Malvavala. She is professor of astrophysics and associate department head of physics at MIT, project lead on LIGO. She, too, spent a long time on this major, major project. You can join us. What do you think? What's it mean to you that the universe has a beat? Have you by now heard the chirp that's been detected of gravitational waves? When the National Science Foundation said last week to stand by for a major announcement, is this what you were expecting? And how do you understand the meaning of gravitational waves? These chirps are that we're going to hear here again, another version, gravitational waves converted to audible sound. Faint thump here. Faint in this presentation of it, matching the gravitational waves frequencies, the louder chirp, a higher frequency presentation better suited to human ears. I just love that. I don't know if we're in a submarine or what. And now for the all-important Saturday Night Live interpretation. Denver Broncos linebacker Von Miller on Saturday Night Live. Weekend Update this weekend to explain the discovery of gravitational waves. Weekend Update anchor Michael Shea interviewed him on the findings.
Now, the gravitational waves were discovered when two black holes collided with each other. Is that correct?
That's right. Let me put it like this. Picture two huge forces slamming together, like, say, me and Cam Newton.
Well, you're just talking about football, man.
No, I'm talking about science. Now, these forces that collide and make gravity waves. Like when I collided with Cam Newton and forced him to fumble.
There's the Saturday Night Live interpretation. We mere mortals trying to get our heads around the meaning of ripples in space and time. Let's hear from Stephen Hawking. He talked with the BBC, congratulating the LIGO team on their discovery of gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves provide a completely new way of looking at the universe. The ability to detect them has the potential to revolutionize astronomy. This discovery is the first detection of a black hole binary system, and the first observation of black holes merging. The observed properties of this system is consistent with predictions about black holes that I made in 1970 here in Cambridge.
Stephen Hawking getting in on the action there. Albert Einstein a century ago. Stephen in 1970. Everybody wants a piece of this beauty. A lot of questions for all three of you from our listeners. I have many as well. But let's go to Ralph in Arlington, Massachusetts. Ralph, you're on the air with folks right at the heart of the LIGO team. What's your question, Ralph?
Yes, hello, Tom. Another superb program. My question is, how do they get the sound out of it? Because the direct evidence is laser signals, which don't make noise. So they're translating the frequency into sound. But I'd like to hear about how they do that, because everybody's saying you can listen to gravity waves, and nobody has explained how they make that translation.
Nurgis, jump right in on that if you would, because, yeah, lasers don't make a sound. So we all love this sound, but how does it relate to what you discovered?
So that's a great question. What happens is the light from the interferometers is encoded into a voltage. So you literally just let the light fall on a photodetector, and that gives you a current. And we then turn that current into a voltage that you can encode onto a loudspeaker. So it's really just the light gets turned into an electrical signal, and the electrical signal then feeds a loudspeaker. And it just turns out that these gravitational waves that LIGO can detect happen to be in the human audio band. And as a result, when you translate that voltage into a loudspeaker signal, we can hear it.
Gabriella, is there any point to that other than communicating it to the world? I mean, is that the whole reason for turning it into sound?
Well, we love the sound of the interferometer.
Well, so do we. It's cool, but...
No, we of course, analyze the signal on computers. We don't have headphones looking for gravitational waves. But we do a lot of diagnostics of the interferometer noise with headphones. Sometimes we can see the ringing of the wires or the mirrors themselves, and those are very high tones. So we do some diagnostics with ears, but most of the analysis is, of course, done on computers.
We want to keep listening, and I'll bring it to you, Ray Wise, here one more time, that sort of deep thump with the higher frequency then coming in. Ray Wise, you've been looking at this for so long. When you listen to that, what are you hearing? When you first heard that, what did it mean to you? What did it say to you?
Well, first of all, let me interpret the sound that you're hearing.
Please.
What you have there is something quite complicated. You're hearing the first little, that thump that you said is just a little thump, is really the signal that we hear. Mm-hmm. And it goes from about the bottom of the piano and ends up at about middle C in a very quick order. That's about the range of that.
Yes.
Of that
sort of profile
chirp,
of that.
Chirp, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then the second part, you're really playing two parts of that
yes.
sound. The second one is one which was artificially speeded up.
Mm-hmm. To make it more audible.
So that it was more likely for your ear to be able to hear it. So when you play this, or if you can think back and remember what you heard,
yeah.
You heard the initial thump that is actually coming out of the instrument, and then you heard a man-made translation of that into different frequencies. That's what you heard. Now, you asked me what I thought of it. We actually didn't hear that right away. We see mm-hmm. the waveform. Mm-hmm. You see it as a thing. And I'll be...
On a computer screen.
You see it on a computer. You can see mm-hmm. it on an oscilloscope. But we saw mm-hmm. it on a computer. Mm-hmm. And I think virtually everybody in the collaboration who was looking that morning didn't believe it.
You thought...
It was
there's
just...
another earthquake. There's another tree.
No. It was just too pretty, too good.
What made it pretty to you?
Pretty means that we could see, well, you hear
the
that...
The clarity of it.
Let me say mm-hmm. what it is. Part of that background noise you hear when you play that recording, that
yes.
hissing noise, that's the noise of the apparatus. That's a background that's
okay.
always there.
Okay.
And then we expected that background noise would be substantially... the signal would be substantially smaller than that background noise. So we would have to apply all sorts of very fancy computational techniques mm-hmm. to be able to see it. What is so amazing about this particular signal was that all you needed to do was have effectively the same thing as you have on your audio, a treble control and a
yep.
bass control,
yep.
and turn the treble down and the bass down,
and
in the mid-band, it just popped right out. And that was unbelievable. So many of us thought, my Lord, this has got to be a fake. And then that's where the investigation began.
Nergis, is the is the signal or the beat, if you want to call it, is it steady? Does it vary? Is it just a steady as a resting heartbeat, or how is it?
So if the interferometer itself is working really well,
yes.
That's that first part we hear. It just sounds like a spa. Shh.
Yes, that's the machine.
And that's the machine. And then the signal
itself.
We thought
it was the universe.
Yes.
God, it sounded so cool, but okay, it's the machine.
But then the signal that's superimposed on top of that, that actually has an increase in frequency and amplitude. So it would sound like... And so,
but is it a steady beat or pulse, if that's the right, or wave?
It's not steady. It's changing in frequency and it's changing in its amplitude. So it's getting louder and higher.
That's within the wave. But right. I guess do the waves come in a steady rhythm?
So no. So you know what? This is the last moments when those two black holes crashed into each other. It's a one shot. They crashed into each other. They wobbled a little as they became a bigger black hole, and then silence again. So the way to think of it is there was silence, just the hum of our instrument. Then the signal from these black holes just as they were getting ready to collide, and then silence again.
Now, how long ago was that collision again?
The collision itself happened 1.3 billion years ago.
And these gravitational waves that we're now hearing, you're saying that this is the petering out of those waves?
They propagated across the universe.
Yes.
And this is when the moment in time when they registered in our detector.
Yes.
And they went right through. They came, they put in a little bit of energy into our detector. We heard them or saw them, whichever you like, and then they pass right through. And they are propagating on.
Yeah, of course.
To the
but
rest
are these
of the
early waves, Ray, out of that collision? Are these middle? Are these late? I don't know.
I think Nergis said it very well. It's as she said, a one shot. These black holes have been around each other for eons. They're very far apart, and they're radiating gravitational waves all the time.
Continuing.
But we can't hear that. There are other instruments that are going to be built that can do that. But our LIGO can't do that. We can only hear them or listen or see the signals once they get into the regime where they're going around each other so fast that they make a signal that's about at 20 hertz, like the bottom of the piano.
Yes.
But they've been doing this for thousands or millions of years ahead of this, but very much more slowly, periods of hours. You can't hear that. Mm-hmm. Periods of days and stuff like that. So the thing that you're hearing then is something which happens at the very last moments of the – and that's at that very dramatic moment when they get so close together that over the one or two revolutions, they're losing complete – fractions total sort of 20% of their energy each time they go around each other. And then all of a sudden they've lost all their kinetic energy and they bop into each other and then they grow and make this new black hole. And there are three definite phases in the signal. One is that very long thing which we hear only the end of, the spiral at the end of. Mm-hmm. That, if with other instruments you can hear it earlier if you want to, but we're not ready for that yet. Mm-hmm. Then as they crash into each other, there's a very special new sound. The frequencies change very dramatically, very much more quickly. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, there is a burp in the geometry of space-time, which we didn't see so well, but it's there when you look with more signal analysis. And that is when the geometry of space-time settles back to being, you've made a new event horizon. It's a region, horizon is the region between the outside world and the inside world of the black hole. And that is a very special part of the geometry. And as that forms with the new black hole, it makes waves that go around the event horizon. And that is a final piece to the signal, which happens to be, in this particular case, near middle C on the piano.
Gabriella, why does this matter? Why does this matter? There are ripples in space and time. It sounds fantastic. I mean, when it's warping space and time and all that. Sounds really groovy. Why does it matter?
Well, you were talking about measuring the pulse of the universe. That's what we will be doing. We will be detecting more of these, and we will be measuring how often they happen, where they come from, how big the black holes are before they merge, after they merge, how fast they spin. That's a new gravitational wave astronomy. That's a new way of looking at the universe, and that's the importance of this.
Will it help us map the universe more accurately or give us a better understanding of what is within the map as we already know it?
Well, these black holes of these masses, have never been seen before. So we are discovering new objects in the universe. We knew black holes existed. We suspected they existed in these masses, but there was no way for us to tell that before we had these detectors. So we will be finding who lives in our universe and what they do.
Wow, that's a lot to learn. I gotta dig into that. Jim in Massillon, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. And first of all, let me just say, it is so great to hear you devote this kind of time to a scientific topic. I've taught science four decades, and ours is not a particularly scientifically literate culture. So let me give you, Tom, and everyone there on the show props for devoting this time.
Well, it's easy, Jim. It's darned exciting, and we've got the principals right here with us. But okay,
it really is, and the Higgs was exciting, too.
Yes.
And so let me get to two things.
Yeah.
A couple of things. First of all, I've kept a notebook on LIGO for two decades. I was wondering, that my simple question is, what happened to the LIGO that was going to be built in Italy if that project fizzled out for some reason? And the second question is a little more complex. Since all masses, you know, distort space-time, and since this was the very first confirmed gravitational wave event at the LIGO, both LIGOs here in North America, How was this signal determined to be indicative of two black holes rather than, say, a collision of galaxies or a supernova or something else? And I guess that's a magnitude answer or something like that.
Wonderful. Nergis?
So both are good questions.
So those are both great questions. I'll actually answer the second one first.
Okay.
And that's a question of how do we know these were black holes and not something else like a supernova, which is an exploding star.
Or galaxies colliding. That's been nagging me night after night.
Yeah, so the way that we know is actually encoded in the frequency of the signal that we measured and in the way that that frequency changes as the chirp progresses.
Okay.
If it were galaxies colliding, just because of the sheer masses involved, the frequencies would be much, much lower and, in fact, not detectable by LIGO. So that rules out galaxies. And what gets left then were these neutron stars, which have some of the same properties as black holes. They're just lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And the frequencies being where they were, being as high as they were, tell us that these were not neutron stars. These were black holes. That's, in fact, how we got the masses.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that these are 30 solar masses was encoded in that chirp signal, actually, remarkably. And so that's how we knew that they were not supernovae, because supernovae don't make chirps,
okay.
We don't think.
Okay.
And so we're left with two black holes because of the masses that we could infer from the signal. And that we got from the frequencies.
And Ray, do we have more facilities coming online in Italy or not? Jim is wondering.
In fact, that's a very good question you asked about how do you begin. Here's this field of what let's call it gravitational wave astronomy, which really, I don't mean to be too grand. It's something that now is going to happen. And it's going to look at the dark universe, the universe that you can't see with your eyes.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to, and for very good reasons, we're going to be able to look at things which we have never seen before because gravitational waves, because they are so hard to detect, it took us so many years to make an instrument that could detect them. These are also the fact is that they don't interact with anything as they come out of their sources. In other words, we see right into the insides of stars, the insides of what's going on, things completely
with these waves.
With these waves. Mm-hmm. They're completely shrouded. If, for example, electromagnetic things, optical light, radio waves, X-rays, gamma rays, all of those things, you see those from stars, but they don't come from deep inside because they come from the outer parts of the system because the light that's generated or the signals that are generated inside the star just don't make it out. But the gravitational waves will make it out. So that's the very exciting thing to all of us as a new prospect. Now, let me answer your question about the other, because this is such a very powerful way of looking at the universe, other countries are very, very interested in doing this. And for example, you asked about the Italian detector. That's been running with us before. It just happens to be rebuilding at this moment. They will be on the air again in October, we hope. And with them, we will be able to do a much better job of when we see the next big black hole pair or whatever it is, identifying where in the universe that actual object is. Right now, we're not very good at determining where it comes from.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, If you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the discovery, the evidence of gravitational waves, Einstein's century-old theory now confirmed, and what that means for our understanding of the universe, for the warping of space and time, the future of the cosmos, our interaction with it, maybe. Ray Weiss is with us, professor emeritus of physics at MIT, co-founder, leader of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory LIGO effort at MIT, Caltech in on this as well. Louisiana State University's Gabriela Gonzalez is with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Of course, big facility down there. It was right at the heart of this, along with another in Washington. Nergis Malvalvala is with us, also out of MIT, all right at the heart of this effort that finally made its announcement to the world last week of all that has been discovered with this sound. Gravitational waves, and we are trying to get some of the measure of what they mean. We feel and hear the excitement in the scientific community, the relief that this enormous billion-dollar-plus effort has paid off with such a profound insight into the universe. Where does this take us? Where do we go? Lots of questions for all three of you. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Ari's calling. Ari, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I actually wanted to know, okay, so now that we have this information, and this source, to say the least, what are we going to do? How are we going to change or adapt to this revolutionized, like, theory?
I mean, I love that because everyone who's not super experts like you guys is like, okay, we hear that it's big, it's momentous, it's profound. What does it mean? I mean, hold that question and let me give you some of the questions that are coming in here online. Neil wants to know how fast gravity waves travel, and do they scatter as they pass by or through objects in space? Are they spreading in a multidimensional way? And then bring it closer to us, Sam wants to know what are the potential implications relating to interstellar space travel? And does this make time travel wormholes more of a reality? I mean, Ray, you know, people are trying to take on board the grandeur of what you guys have discovered. Help us.
Well, let me start by, I don't think it'll do much for space travel. I think we have to
learn
how to do other things for that.
Can we surf on these waves?
But it tells us something really quite profound about how we should now look at the theory of gravity, or how we this thing which we experience every day, and when we drop things off a table and curse when it cracks on the floor. It turns out that the Einstein way of looking at it seems to be the right way to look at it. In other words, Einstein invented this theory which didn't have the forces that you'd learn about in high school or in first year college.
Old Newtonian.
You know, Newtonian theory is right as an approximation. But what Einstein did when he spent November of 1915 really working very, very, very hard on getting the proper equations for this. And after he did that, but what did he tell us? He told us that actually one way to think about it is that what matter does, it distorts space and time. Clocks move at different rates. Space actually warps, as you have said, Tom. Mm-hmm. And that is due to the matter that is in it. And then there's another side to it. The distortion of space and the slowing and speeding up of time also tells matter how to move. So it's a very beautiful system of things. And this system, then, has now been confirmed by, to me, that's one of the more important things about this. It's been confirmed in a level where, at a strength of gravitational, you know, the strength of gravity,
okay,
in a regime we live in is very, very weak.
Earth's gravity is
Earth's gravity is weak on a grand scale,
yes,
when you think about it.
Yeah.
It turns out that one way of thinking of it is Earth gravity is call it 10 to the minus 10. That's 10. That's what a decimal point with nine zeros and a one.
So we're in gravity light here.
Yeah, it's tiny. We're very, very light gravity, right? But it's pretty profound already.
Yeah, when then I carry the groceries, it seems like a lot.
Then you go to the surface of the sun, which was the first place where the Einstein theory was tested, and people saw that light deflected around the sun. And there, that strength is about 10 to the minus 6. That's 10,000 times bigger than where we live. And then here we are in a regime where it's the whole story. That same number is no longer a fraction. It's one. And that's what's going on black holes.
Okay.
And the theory still works.
Gabriella, how did Einstein, without LIGO, figure out this theory? I mean, he was just sitting around.
That's
awesome. You guys have giant machinery at work for you. He was just sitting around. How did he come to this?
Well, I think the inspiration he had was to create a theory in which the force of gravity did not propagate instantaneously, because he had created this universal speed limit, the speed of light, and according to Newton, the force of gravity travels instantaneously, and he didn't like that. So his theory was a theory in which gravity is a distortion of space-time that travels at the speed of light. And that's what we have measured directly. It's that distortion of space-time, which to him and to many people was all mathematics in the beginning. Now it's a reality.
Nirgis, what does the distortion mean or matter? It complicates our understanding of Newtonian physics. There are waves, and space and time, space is warped. Time is not consistent, as Ray says. Therefore...
So I think, you know, your caller Ari asked actually a very profound question, which was just the fact that we have been able to measure this waving is new. I mean, Einstein predicted it, but, you know, that's right. And so,
amen.
And the fact that those waves travel at the speed of light is part of Einstein's theory. The fact that they carry energy and therefore information across the universe is in some ways a tool. It's no longer just, okay, the theory worked. It's now a tool. We have a way. They're a messenger that now will carry messages about the system from which they originate.
Are they better at that than light has been?
I mean,
light we've already played with a lot.
Yes. Are they better
Why?
At it? No. I wouldn't say they're better at it. They're different at it, and they give us different information. Ray already
says, "Well, look at the dark universe with these."
Well, Ray pointed out what's the advantage? The advantage is that light is extremely friendly. Every time light meets particles, mm-hmm. light interacts and hangs out mm-hmm. and gets kind of deflected and doesn't mm-hmm. come to us. In pristinely.
Mm-hmm.
Gravitational waves, extremely aloof. They go through everything.
Right through.
They pass right through. So if you want to look into the cores of star systems, if you want to look all the way back to the very beginning of time, at the Big Bang itself, light is not going to give you that information. You have to find something else, and this is our messenger, we think.
So, Ray, this will enable a more accurate understanding of the universe. We can see more accurately with less disruption, and therefore we may learn what?
Well, we may learn a lot of things. For example, it may very well be, and something we didn't know, that every galaxy needs to have a black hole in it. We're getting there already.
You mean to be created in
To make a galaxy, mm-hmm. you might need to have a black hole to begin
okay.
it. That's sort of a strange idea that wasn't
mm-hmm.
around before.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that black holes might very well have a very important role to play in the beginning of the universe. For example, right after the very first stars are formed in the universe, which are very strange stars. They're stars we don't really understand very well
mm-hmm.
because they're made only of hydrogen. It may very well be that they immediately, when they get in, when they no longer can constrain themselves against gravity and they collapse, they turn into black holes. That would be a fascinating thing to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? These are all these kinds of new pieces of information that will come from this. And we fully expect, as with every revolution in astronomy, that when you open a new way of looking at it, and that's happened over and over again, with neutrinos, with X-rays, with every conceivable way, you mm-hmm. will learn things I can't even tell you yet.
Is there going to be some kind of micro application of this in our tiny little human domain? Are we going to start, I don't know, having gravitational wave ovens?
No, I doubt that.
Or vacations brought to you by gravitational wave ink?
I'm not going to hold that out as a promise. I'm not imaginative enough imaginative enough to do that. So, but my guess is, if I had to predict the future for man, they're not going to be able to manipulate gravitational waves easily.
It's all on a cosmic scale here.
You have to have huge masses, large velocities. That's not yet in our capability.
We can't sleep a little later because of this warp time business.
Well, you can dream, and that allows you to sleep longer, you know?
Yes, no, it does. It stretches everything. Mike in Slidell, Louisiana. Mike, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, congratulations. I live just down the road from the Livingston Parish.
All right.
Oh, wow.
And last year, Philip Penko, he's more on the cosmological end. He came into LSU in New Orleans, gave a talk. And there's two questions that we may not be able to field here. So I've got a third one that's pretty obvious, and it would involve the Galileo satellites. Will the satellites correlate with the frequency or whatever you would regard your machine detecting? And then the two harder questions. There's a phenomena of the further cosmological bodies rushing away. It looks like gravity repels at some distance. How will that figure in? Because detectors need to anticipate how things actually work to detect them. And then the third question, and this one's the one I asked Filipenko, and it's not really a pat answer to this one. The three forces, gravity, electric, magnetic fields, they at some point may have been equal. And that would really be a breakthrough for understanding the cosmos and, you know, and the quantum end. And I guess that's it. I don't know.
That's a full table. Ray, pick that one up first.
I'll try. That's not a straightforward and simple question. Let me start. I think you've taken a whole bunch of things. Let me start with the business of the repulsive gravity, which you mentioned, which was another big discovery within your and my lifetime. And that is that when you start looking at the universe as an entirety, you know, you look at all the motions, all the objects in the universe, you find out that there is a part to gravity that looks like it's not attractive, but repulsive. And that's something that is now we're trying to figure out what that is. We don't really have a good feel for it, but the experiments and the observations, not the experiments, but the observations indicate that. There may very well be, and this, I cannot predict this, but there may very, very well be a relationship between gravitational waves and how the universe expands. That people will have to know more, have to build bigger detector systems than the one we have now. But don't throw that idea away. There may be a new revelation from the expansion of the universe being driven by this
repulsive
this repulsive part. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that the fact that you can see something, for example, there will be, and I think this is a project for LISA, which is LISA, which is a space project, that you can look at an astronomical system, see it with, let's say, a binary system, two stars going around each other, see it, and then measure and register the gravitational waves from it while you're looking at it. That is also in the cards, but not necessarily for LIGO right away. It's in the cards for LISA, which is looking at slower gravitational waves. What was that? Lower frequency. And that's a project that NASA will do and the European Space Agency will eventually do. There is a piece to what you're asking, and this is the last thing I'll say, which is close to what you're asking. We are very eager when we detect something on LIGO. We send out telegrams to the people who have telescopes, radio telescopes, X-ray telescopes. Mm-hmm. We tell them, we've seen something. Please look in some part of the sky and see if you see something also. And that idea of pulling together the electromagnetic astronomy, the astronomy that's well established, with this new astronomy of gravitational wave astronomy is a very important way to make the science that we're going to do far more interesting and more connected to the rest of the things we already know. So that's a hope for the future. We already did it for the black holes that we saw. We sent telegrams out.
Yeah.
And I don't know for sure that anybody saw anything that was coincident with our signal.
But Gabriella, our caller is just down the road from you there. I mean, most people don't have a LIGO observatory in their backyard or in the garage. I mean, can people really jump on and help with these observations, or is this just mega science?
Well, detecting gravitational waves is mega science. It really needs bigger detectors. And as it was mentioned later, earlier, there are other detectors that are going to join the network in other countries.
What about satellites?
But,
our listener
asked
about.
Satellites, mm-hmm. Right. But that's the most exciting part. Like Ray was saying, we are sending these alerts to everybody. In probably later this year or next year, we will have these alerts public so that anybody can follow them up. And we expect many amateur astronomers to be following these, especially they have played a very important role in discovering supernovas and many different objects. So they will be of great help for this too.
Nurgis, you know, we look back at early maps made of the world, back to the 16th century, 17th, 14th, 15th, and they look bizarre. You know, continents are all weird shapes and there's sea monsters jumping around in the water. Is it possible we'll look back on the using gravitational waves now and look back on our understanding of the cosmos and its shape and dimension and map, if you will, and say it will look as antique and distorted one day as those old pen and ink maps look to us today?
Personally, I hope so, because I think we've really just chipped at the tip of the iceberg of what the universe looks like in gravitational waves. And I think history eventually, time will tell how tectonic was this shift. Mm-hmm. But it's almost certainly we will come to a point in time, whether it's 50 years from now, 100 years from now, or longer, where we will have maps of the sky, just as we had maps of the sky with optical light, just mm-hmm. what telescopes could see, mm-hmm. X-rays, what could X-rays see. Mm-hmm. We'll have maps of the sky, what it looks like in gravitational waves, and I bet you anything, there will be enormous surprises.
Ray, if you could on this occasion, say something to Albert Einstein a century after he brought this out. And what would you like to say to Albert?
I've said this before. I would love to show him just what we showed the public on last Thursday. I would like to see his face. I mean, he would probably be flabbergasted. And there's a couple of reasons. One of them is he didn't really believe in black holes. It was a solution of the field equations, which he didn't believe. Mm-hmm. And and in his very first paper on gravitational waves, he makes a statement which is really quite remarkable. He says, these probably will never play a role in physics or in reality. And that's right in his paper, in his 1916 paper. Wow. And the reason he said that was very obvious. In 1916, the technology wasn't there to do this. And also, the astrophysics wasn't known enough. People didn't know that there were black holes, that there were neutron stars.
In 2016, here we are. Ray Weiss, Gabriela Gonzalez, Nurgis Mavavala, congratulations to all of you. What an amazing moment we live at. What an enormous and wonderful discovery you bring and share with us. Thank you so much, Ray, Nurgis. Gabriela,
thank you for having us.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you to all.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.